How is the weather today in Egypt?
The weather is sunny. It's about 18 degrees and there's light traffic in the street.
Okay, just to make sure, because there seems to have been some controversy about what the weather was like on Wednesday. I hear that Morsi didn't go to the second hearing of his trial because apparently the weather was too bad for a helicopter to fly.
Right, this is the reason given by the official authorities about transferring Morsi from the prison he's being held in Alexandria to the courthouse in Cairo. The official response was that the weather was unfavorable. However, many people speculate that the real reason was to not have Morsi appear in court on that day for the fear that it would have galvanized his supporters to take to the streets in larger numbers, especially ahead of the referendum on the Constitution that is scheduled for just in a few days on the 14th and 15th of the...
It had nothing to do with the weather then.
Well, we don't know exactly what the real reason is. It's very unlikely that the weather, which wasn't that bad that day, there was some fog, but that would prevent a helicopter, a military helicopter, from flying. So it's a very, very dubious claim.
Maybe the timing was a bit, was not very well planned then, because if indeed there is this referendum and people want everything to be calm for the referendum, then it's not a good moment for a big protest.
Well, you know, one part of result of the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi has been almost constant protests in the streets since the two major prisons of the president were cleared in a very brutal massacre on August 14th.
Mm-hmm.
That was the deadliest day in Egypt for in Egypt's modern history. Since then, there have been protests almost every day, if not every other day. In different parts of the country, there have been protests on university campuses. Many, many hundreds and thousands of Muslim Brotherhood supporters have been arrested on the streets. And the crackdown by the police and by the security services has also targeted non-supporters of Mohamed Morsi, but those who were protesting the government and many of those same activists that really launched the revolution and sustained it. So people like Alaa Abdel Fattah, the founder of the April 6th movement, Ahmed Deh, these prominent secular activists are also in prison, case after case, going to courts, prosecuting and trying these activists. So the current government is very much against any kind of opposition, whether it comes from Islamists and supporters of Mohamed Morsi or from other political factions.
Yes, that was going to be my next question. Is the protest only by people of the Muslim Brotherhood? But apparently it's not. Is there a kind of alliance between the Muslim Brotherhood and the other opposition?
No, there's no. There's very little alliance. I would say they're not all Muslim Brotherhood members who are going out to support Morsi or to call for his reinstatement. But, you know, these are mainly a lot of the people that took part in the major sit-in and so forth. And they are sympathetic to the former president. However, certainly there's a large faction of activists like the people I just mentioned, like the April 6 Youth Movement and Alaa Abdel Fattah, and other activists who, you know, were really instrumental in beginning the revolution, do not trust in any way whatsoever the Muslim Brotherhood, because Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, while during their brief time in power, cheered and applauded the security forces when they were killing and torturing and arresting protesters who were on the streets opposed to Mohamed Morsi's rule. So they view that the Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi did not want to reform the state in any way, that they wanted a brutal security apparatus. The current interior minister is the man appointed by Morsi in January of 2013. And so they view that the Brotherhood didn't want to reform the state. They just wanted to harness it, to get control of parts of the state in order to use it for their own interests. So they feel very, very betrayed by the Muslim Brotherhood. Some of them voted for Morsi in 2012, only to see him use the same language and the same techniques as previous authoritarian leaders have. So that's why there's this disconnect now, a big disconnect, between those who support the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi, and those who oppose the current government, but definitely do not support Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. They see the military and the Muslim Brotherhood as two different wings. of a counter-revolution.
Mm-hmm. Now, the referendum is due next week, and what was the referendum about?
So the referendum is going to be held on the 14th and 15th of January, referendum on the Constitution. This is a new constitution that replaces the constitution pushed through by the Muslim Brotherhood in 2012. It has differences and advantages and disadvantages in different ways. People point to greater religious freedoms in this document, greater freedoms for women's rights and children's rights and so forth. However, it also further empowers the institutions of the state that backed the overthrow of Morsi. So the police has greater autonomy in this constitution. The army has greater autonomy and control in this constitution, and the judiciary as well has greater autonomy and control. So it empowers these parts of the state that backed the coup and backed the overthrow of Morsi.
Yes,
so it's a controversial document. Also, the body that wrote the document, members, a 50-member committee, didn't include any members of the Muslim Brotherhood. It only included one member who can be considered representative of Islamist political groups, a member of the Salafi Noor Party. So it excluded a big section of the electorate in right, and that's also why it's criticized. And finally, the larger question is, what difference would a constitution, even if it passes, will not bring stability. Just by having this document be passed and become law will not provide stability, because at the end of the day, the underlying problems have not changed. The police and the security forces are the biggest violators of the law. They regularly kidnap activists, jail them, torture them. And this is done with the approval and help of the prosecutors, with the judiciary. So passing a constitution may be all well and good, but if the institutions of the state don't abide by the rule of law, then it's meaningless.
Sure. So, and people have to vote for or against. They cannot say we want this part and this part we would rather not have.
No, it's exactly. It's just a yes-no vote. Right now, there's hardly any major group is calling for a no vote. Most of the big political parties are calling for a yes vote. The Muslim Brotherhood and some other groups are calling for a boycott because they see the whole process as illegitimate. A couple of smaller parties are indeed calling for a no vote, for people to participate but vote no. But some of them are reconsidering to call for a boycott because, for example, members of the Egypt Strong Party were putting up posters calling for a no vote. And there's posters everywhere across the Cairo and across the country calling for a yes vote, big billboards and all over the bridges, huge saying vote yes. But the small party, some members were putting up posters to say vote no. 12 of them were arrested. They were eventually let go, but this calls into question if this vote has any semblance of being fair.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it of any value not to go? I mean, will the referendum only be valid if a certain percentage of the population is going?
No, there is no threshold for it to pass.
So it will be passed.
This is always a big argument between boycotting or going to vote no.
Uh-huh.
Last constitution, that was also very controversial because it was written by mostly only Islamists and it included a walkout by almost all the non-Islamist parties. And it was a controversial document, and it was very much forced through. The turnout in that referendum was only 33%, and it passed with something like 65% voting yes. So, in fact, the number of people that voted for that constitution, the actual number, is less than the number of people who voted for the rival of Mohamed Morsi, the one who lost him in the presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a low turnout, and it's hard to tell what this going to be. There are two concerns. One is, I think people are afraid of security concerns.
Yes.
There have been protests and clashes on an almost daily basis. The government is very much trying to alleviate these concerns. It says it deploy 130,000 police and army soldiers to guard polling stations. But the Brotherhood have said that they want to go out in marches and protests on the day.
But
so for some Egyptians, they might not want to go to vote on that day. And I think on a larger level, I think many more Egyptians are becoming increasingly alienated and dissatisfied with the political process, that they see it as something that does not really affect their lives anymore. And this is the way it was before the revolution began, that, you know, politics was seen as something of a power struggle between different political factions and not as a tool to solve people's everyday problems. And so that might be another reason the turnout will be low. However, we never know. And in Egypt, we don't know. I think, you know, the turnout could also be high. It's hard to tell, really, in electoral politics in this country.
Okay, but so the Brotherhood has announced marches, but peaceful marches. Nobody has said...
They're not allowed to march.
Okay.
Allowed to march, but they will march. I mean, they, you know, no one's allowed to protest. I mean, in November, the military-backed government passed a law, a very draconian protest law, that basically doesn't allow a group of more than 10 people to assemble in a public space without prior approval from the police. So many people have been arrested under this law. Many secular activists have been arrested under this law. So yeah, so they're not allowed to protest, but the Muslim Brotherhood has said they will. Just yesterday, on Friday, you know, there was marches and protests, mostly Morsi supporters who were protesting. 3 people were killed, 169 mm-hmm. people were arrested, and that was just, you know, a regular Friday.
Is it more on Fridays?
Fridays are usually the mm-hmm. day of protest in Egypt, yes, because mm-hmm. it's a holiday. It is the day that people go to pray in the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And so typically after the noon prayers, people go out and marches. And this has been the case since the beginning of the revolution, and it has continued, that Friday is a day of protest. And
mm-hmm. Now, is there nothing in the constitution about basic rights, like a right to protest? Because
the constitution is a badly written document, first of all. Many of the clauses and the amendments have the caveats that say, as regulated by law, which weakens the fundamental rights that are outlined. So you have, for example, freedom of speech as regulated by law. So if the parliament passes a law that dilutes this freedom, it is acceptable. So this is the problem, I think, overall as a legal document. It is weakly written, and it has contradictory statements in it. As I said before, there are benefits. You know, it has good language on women's rights and children's rights and economic rights and things like this. But in the face of what is actually happening on the ground, it is meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, the Constitution Committee was voting to pass the Constitution, to put it to a referendum, security forces were shooting tear gas and arresting people and throwing them in prison and beating them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the grand, many people feel that in the broader scale of things, it's irrelevant.
Only that it gives a larger piece of the cake to the people who are already in power.
And I think that the current regime is very much looking to solidify this transition with any kind of vote. So they're very much trying to go forward with this referendum, which is taking place. And then the next step after that, we still don't even know what the next step is, whether it will be presidential elections first or parliamentary elections first. Many speculate that it will be presidential first. And the very big question about that is all over the press, the talk of the town, is whether the head of the army, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, will run for president or not.
Mm-hmm.
If he does, other candidates have said they would drop out if he ran. And I think it would change the form of the state, depending on whether he runs or not.
And are there other possible candidates?
People, there's been names floating around, candidates that came second and third in the presidential election in 2012. People like Hamdine Sabahi, who's a Nasserist candidate, who came in third in the presidential elections. The idea of Amr Moussa has also come, who was the Secretary General of the Arab League for 10 years, who was the head of the Constitutional Committee that wrote this constitution.
Mm.
He came in fifth in the last presidential elections. But there's no serious consideration. Everyone is still asking the question, will Sisi run? If he doesn't, I think then we'll see some names start to emerge. But part of the problem in Egypt is that we don't have very many credible politicians anymore that have a history and a background and that are popular or known by vast segments of society.
Mm-hmm.
So this is part of the issue.
So when would those elections take place? What's the plan now?
Well, again, this was all supposed to be finalized by the Constitutional Committee that wrote the Constitution, but they didn't finalize it, and they left all these questions up to the interim president to decide. And as of yet, we don't know. It should be within 6 months of the Constitution passing that we have some kind of vote, either presidential or parliamentary. But we have yet to tell. So it's very chaotic and turbulent. And in the meantime, you know, this repression and crackdown is increasing. So more and more people are being sent to prison. More and more people are receiving jail sentences for minor infractions. They just arrested on December 29th three journalists working for Al Jazeera English. They now, and these are veteran reporters, one of whom worked for CNN for a long time, another one worked for BBC. Both of them are award-winning journalists. They now face accusations of joining a terrorist group, which is a reference to the Muslim Brotherhood, and endangering national security by publishing false information. Very serious charges. At least two of these journalists, one of whom has been kept in solitary confinement for the last 11 days in a maximum security wing of the prison, forced to sleep on the floor with insects. So very punitive and harsh conditions. And so this is the type of repression that we're seeing in Egypt, and that's continuing. People are being surveilled and monitored. Their phone calls are being recorded. Some very pro-military TV channels have released recordings of very prominent activists talking to each other as a way to say they're part of a conspiracy. Things like this. So it's a harsh atmosphere in Egypt. And it also, unfortunately, there's a lot of public support for this crackdown. There's a lot of people who just want... They have been manipulated very heavily by the media, which completely supports the military, both the state and private media. And so it's almost a fascistic atmosphere right now.
Mm-hmm. But you say the media are completely controlled, but you are part of something that's called Mossirin.
Right. So I said, the state and private media. So media, of course, is always in Egypt a propaganda arm of the government. And the private media is almost invariably owned by big businessmen or political groups who serve those interests. I'm part of an independent media collective called Mossirin, which was formed in 2011, born out of the streets of the revolution, as a way to start an independent media movement in this country. As I said, the state and private media only serve those in power and act very much as a mouthpiece for those in power. So what Mossirin and other independent media groups like are trying to do in Egypt is to give voice to those people on the streets who are not listened to on TV or in the newspapers, the voices of revolutionaries, the voices of workers, the voices of people who are poor, who are usually the target of the security forces, people who are poor, who are going on strike or work stoppage to protest their economic conditions. And a lot of these videos are put out online using YouTube, using other social media. And in 2007, a lot of these videos would then be picked up by some of the private media, and they would actually be aired on TV, and they would have big effects. But right now, the atmosphere is less conducive to that. Mossirin also has workshops teaching people how to shoot, how to edit, how to create these kinds of videos and to try and encourage more citizen journalism. And there's also independent screenings of independent films and advocacy and pain work for groups like No to Military Trials and so forth. So, I think it's a very important movement. I believe that independent media is essential to functioning society. It's still a small movement in Egypt, but we are hoping that it can grow.
Aren't you targeted then by security forces?
Any journalist right now working, either if you go to cover a protest, it's much more dangerous now. So just virtue of being on the streets covering these protests, it is dangerous. I have not been singled out as a reporter for my work, but again, a lot of my work is in English, and it's for, The Nation magazine and Democracy Now!, which is not as well known by the Egyptian state as other media outlets. Journalists that they tend to target are Arabic language journalists, who obviously have a greater effect here, And some foreign reporters, as I mentioned, like Al Jazeera English has been targeted, and some other kind of big nations have been targeted. As a, you know, they attack CNN and so forth, saying CNN does not support them, but they rarely see any prison time or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to a few weeks ago, apparently there is a new law that has been passed about terror.
Well, it's not a terror law. It's on December 5th, the cabinet designated the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization. So this came after a bombing in Mansoura, which is a town just north of Cairo, that targeted a security headquarters and killed 16 people and injured up to 100. After that bombing, the Prime Minister issued a statement designating the Muslim Brotherhood, the entire group, as a terrorist organization. They did not provide any evidence linking the Muslim Brotherhood to the attack. A militant group in Sinai called Ansar Beit al-Maqdis claimed responsibility for the attack, but they ignored that and designated the group a terrorist group. What the Interior Ministry said afterwards was that anyone taking part in a Muslim Brotherhood protest can get up to 5 years in prison. Someone leading a Muslim Brotherhood protest can get life sentence or the death penalty. They began closing down hundreds of charities and groups linked to the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood had an empire of schools and hospitals and so forth that it had built over many years, and it began freezing the assets of these groups because they designated it a terrorist group. So this basically intensifies the crackdown against the group. It ends any small possibility of a negotiated political solution to the crisis that Egypt is facing, and instead is going towards a security solution, what is essentially a political problem.
So the Brotherhood has never itself claimed any attack, any violent attack?
No, I didn't say that. The Muslim Brotherhood, as an organization, officially renounced violence in the 1970s. However, that's not to say that some of its members, or at least some of its supporters, have been engaged in violence. We saw over the summer, immediately after the ouster of Mohamed Morsi, supporters of Mohamed Morsi attack protests, kill people in different neighborhoods of Cairo. We saw a huge number of attacks on churches, monasteries, Christian schools and offices around the country in retaliation, because the Brotherhood has regularly used very sectarian language to further its political goals and has often portrayed the opposition to Morsi as being some kind of Christian-led conspiracy. And this has had an effect on the ground with Islamist supporters around the country, whether they're members of the Brotherhood or not, have reacted and have attacked churches and monasteries and so forth. So the Brotherhood is not a violence-free organization. The question is, can you label an entire group of which its membership probably goes in the range of 5,000 people as a terrorist organization in its whole? And I think a lot of analysts and critics think that that is, first of all, incorrect, and second of all, only pushes more and more people who support the Brotherhood into militancy, into seeking a militant solution to the problems, and in fact just sends us down a spiral of violence.
Yes, of course. The chances of the Brotherhood becoming more of a terrorist organization are higher now, I think.
Maybe not the Brotherhood itself, but at least people breaking off from the group, young members joining more militant groups, you know, and so this is a real danger, because this is the Brotherhood in Egypt was, you know, the grandfather of all political Islamist groups, really. And if it goes in that direction, it can have a very serious effect on the region.
Mm-hmm. So about this other group, this Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, what are they?
Well, very little is known about them. This is a new group that sprung up last year. It's based in Sinai, and not much is known about them. From what we understand, it's a combination of Sinai-based militants who may have help from other militants from the region as well, different kinds of jihadis. But they have claimed responsibility for a series of attacks most notably that bombing I explained before,
mm-hmm.
also the attempted assassination of the interior minister, the successful assassination of a senior intelligence officer. They recently abducted three union workers in Sinai who were going to a meeting, I think in support of the military. So they have, you know, in their statements and in actions, been a violent group, and the military has been conducting a very big campaign in Sinai against militants in Sinai. It's very hard to report from there because the military doesn't allow reporters in, or it does allow reporters in, but it's very dangerous to be there. And a couple of reporters who have said, one very prominent journalist who's based in Sinai, reported that the military in its bombing of militants hit civilian areas, and he was arrested and put on military trial and received a one-year suspended sentence. So it's difficult to get what the real actions on the ground are in that part of the country.
Okay, but they are more prone to violence then. So another question I wanted to ask you, what about this U.S. aid for the military in Egypt?
Does it
a very large sum? I read $1.3 billion yearly going from the U.S. To the military.
Has for the past 30 years been the biggest supporter of the Egyptian military. It provides $1.3 billion every year to the military.
Wow.
A lot of that has to be spent on buying American weapons and tanks and F-16s.
I see. It's a kind of subsidy. But what is the official reason for doing that?
Well, this came out of the Camp David Accords that was signed in 1979 that cemented the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. Israel is the largest recipient of military aid from the United States, and Egypt is the second largest. So it forms the cornerstone of U.S. policy. The United States has long seen Egypt, and it knows that the military is the backbone of autocracy in Egypt. It is the backbone of the regime. Every president, except for Mohamed Morsi, came from the military. And they have long backed the military, supported them. They have very close ties with middle-ranking officers who often go to U.S. Army War College in the United States to study. So there's some very close ties there. And it forms the bedrock of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. The main concerns for the United States regarding Egypt have to do with easy access to the Suez Canal for warships, overflight rights for military aircraft, securing the border with Israel and maintaining the peace treaty. So things that have to do with security of the Persian Gulf, as the United States perceives it, but very little to do with human rights, rule of law, and justice in Egypt. So, I mean, we've seen the same policy continues different U.S. presidents and different Egyptian leaders. So whether it's Ronald Reagan or George Bush or Barack Obama, they all supported Hosni Mubarak. After the revolution, they have all supported the military, whether it's Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that replaced Mubarak. When the Brotherhood was in power, they were looking for a big political player to fulfill their needs. I think they saw the Brotherhood as a potential player. They backed them as well. But their ties with the military have always been strong. And in this latest crisis, after the military overthrew Morsi, we saw them trying very hard not to call Morsi's overthrow a coup. Because
mm-hmm.
under U.S. law, if the U.S. is not allowed to fund any government that has taken power through a coup. So they made some very hyper-legalistic reasoning, saying that they did not need to designate whether it was a coup or not, and they decided to continue the funding. Over summer, they did cut some of the funding. They delayed the shipment of some F-16s. They cut portions of the funding. However, this was really, I think, only symbolic. It was just a slap on the wrist. And now they're considering legislation in the United States to resume the full funding again.
So
this is continuing the same kind of relationship Egypt and the United States have seen for decades. And one of the results of that is a continuation of dictatorship in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. So how did they react to the decision to call the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization?
Well, they, as they've reacted in many other ways, the State Department spokesperson, issued a call of concern, calling for all negotiate together. It's usually a statement of concern or at the very latest, the very most, a statement of condemnation. But that is even rarer. But these are just statements, and there's very little change in actual policy.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other countries where the Muslim Brotherhood has been called terrorists?
Not that. I mean, well, you know, it's a very different organization in different countries. They have links, but the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is very different from the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. That's different from the group that came out of the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza, Hamas. So they're very loosely linked. You know, I'm pretty sure in Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood is outlawed. I'm not sure if it's technically a terrorist organization, but they're certainly treated as one.
Okay. Our time is up. So thank you, Sharif Abdelkoudous, for this interview on a Saturday. And maybe we will talk to you sometime later.
Thank you very much. Goodbye. Bye.